Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of Green and Red Podcast. I'm your co-host Scott Parkin in Berkeley, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko.
And today we are picking up on another story of state repression. Joining us is our regular guest and friend, Adam Fetterman. Adam covers two beats. One is public lands, environmental policy, like around Arctic policy. So we talked to Adam about things like Greenland. But then his other beat is state repression, which kind of started as environmental, repression of environmental activists, but has grown with the Trump, in the Trump era. And Adam works at Type Investigations as a reporting fellow. He's written extensively on corporate and police spying on environmental activists, like I just said. He's appeared in The Guardian, Politico, The Nation. In these times, Adam, welcome back to the Green and Red Podcast.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
And when we left, I think we last talked to you in March, the trial for the nine folks in Prairie Land had just wrapped up. They'd been found guilty. Last week, these anti-ICE protesters were sentenced from 30 to 100 years in jail. Just barbaric sentences, in my opinion. They've been accused by federal prosecutors of being an Antifa terror cell. And they had attended a protest outside the Prairie Land ICE facility in Alvarado, Texas, July 4th, almost a year ago, where fireworks were set off and then there were shots exchanged between one of the activists and a police officer, where the police officer was wounded. But all of these folks were found guilty in March. And so the sentencing has come out, and I think it's sent shockwaves through a lot of people. Can you explain what took place with the sentencing and what the defendants are facing? Because you're obviously following the story very closely.
Yeah. As you said, they were convicted in March on nearly all of the charges. There are a variety of charges from organizing a riot to material support for terrorists, conspiracy, among others, attempted murder, of course, in the case of Benjamin Song, who was found guilty on that charge and sentenced to 100 years in prison, although there remain questions about exactly what happened that evening. I think that I was at the trial the last week in March, so I was there for jury deliberations. And when the convictions were delivered, that certainly sent shockwaves through the community of activists, family members, and observers who had attended the trial. And I think largely not only because they were in many ways connected to these individuals, but because the government's case seemed so threadbare. The evidence presented, the kind of conspiracy concocted to support the terrorism charges, the expert witness, and on. It just didn't feel like a compelling case. And I think that is part of the reason why the defense rested and didn't call any of their own witnesses, which was also a surprise and a decision that has been questioned in light of what has happened. The sentencing, I think, to be completely honest, I was less shocked by the magnitude of the sentencing than I was by the convictions, because I didn't expect the judges in this case, Judge Pittman, who's a Trump appointee, a member of the Federalist Society, and a very controversial individual in the Fort Worth District Court, I didn't expect them to show any leniency. And there's one other defendant who remains to be sentenced on July 1st. And then the individuals who cooperated with the government in exchange for reduced charges are also set to be sentenced. So this is just context. And of course, the defendants face state-level charges, and the appeals process can now move ahead in earnest. And we don't know yet how the defense teams are going to approach that.
Could we be a little more precise on the actual, these charges of terrorism and being an anti-vist? So what were they? They were going to an ICE facility, right? To essentially make noise. And some of the people who were convicted weren't even there. They were like this. So they, like you said, I would say threadbare is generous. It's less than that, right? But what were they actually doing that?
Well, it started out as a kind of standard noise demonstration in which activists. It was July 4th, so people are setting fireworks off across the state. They decided to go to the Prairie Land Detention Center, which is a kind of infamous facility in Texas that has detained a number of high-profile immigrants, and conditions there are dismal. So there had actually been a protest outside of the facility earlier in the day, which some of the same activists had attended. This later event was structured around the fireworks, essentially, to show solidarity with the detainees inside the facility. It was late. I think it started at 11 p.m. A couple of the individuals who were involved in the protest decided to spray paint a guard shack and I think slash tires of a vehicle that was parked at the facility, dismantled a surveillance camera, and a couple of employees of the privately run detention center came outside to confront the activists and at that point called the police, which precipitated the arrival of this trooper, who, it should be noted, this is an important detail that was not shared with the defense before the trial. The officer actually pulled his weapon first. He got out of his car with a weapon in one hand and his radio in the other. One of the activists apparently was moving away from the scene, and the officer was allegedly pointing his weapon at this individual who was moving away. That's when Benjamin Song picked up his rifle and started firing and struck the officer just below the neck on the shoulder, grazed him. He went to the hospital. He was released same day, not seriously injured. So that's how things unfolded. And of course, Song was not apprehended immediately. He went on the run for about 11 days, in which time the FBI conducted raids on various households. The individual who was not at the protest, who you mentioned, was the husband of Maricela Rueda, I believe. He moved a box of anarchist zines, political publications that they had made out of their home, moved that box. She had asked him to. He moved it to a friend's apartment, which was also raided by the FBI. Dez, as he's known, was arrested and charged with conspiracy to conceal evidence and convicted and sentenced to 30 years in prison, not even at the protest.
30 years.
30 years for moving a box of protected. Do we have to say that publishing political zines is something that is lawful? So these are all elements of the case. It's easy to lose sight of some of these important details in the context of the way that the administration has structured the narrative about a kind of dangerous and violent Antifa cell. And we can talk about the FBI records that I obtained that were not included in discovery, which contradict the government's case, and their questions about why they weren't included. The judge denied a motion by the defense for any law enforcement records related to quote unquote North Texas Antifa cell. The judge denied that motion. Not only did he deny the motion, but he fined each of the attorneys for engaging in what he described as frivolous conduct. So he really put his thumb on the scale in this case, Judge Pittman. We declared a mistrial on day one when it seemed like the jury pool was not necessarily favorable to ICE or to what had happened. So some of these questions will be aired in the appeals process and also in the state level cases when more information is turned over as part of discovery. But all of these gears turn very slowly. And in the meantime, of course, these individuals have been in prison since July 4 of last year.
Just a note, I think it's been on social media where you've been posting about things left out of the trial and then also left out of the media. And one of them is this FOIA files that you got saying that they had actually looked into DFW Antifa, which as far as I know is a social media account. Maybe it's other things too, but they had said that they were not a threat. They were not a problem. And could you talk about that? I have some bigger picture questions about MPSM7 here, but touch on that real quick.
Yeah. So these were FOIA records that I got through a request unrelated to Antifa. It actually stretches back to the Keystone Pipeline campaign. And these two pages of this larger investigative file ended up in this release. And at the time, I didn't think anything of it because I wasn't writing about Antifa and it was a non-issue. And it was only after the Prairie Land noise demo and everything that followed that I realized, okay. And in fact, it wasn't even after that. We have to remember that the whole Antifa narrative was not trotted out until after Charlie Kurtz's assassination, after the executive order, after the presidential memo. That's when they started to talk about it in terms of a North Texas Antifa cell, and they put together this conspiracy argument. So I came to the story, I was not tracking it closely, but I realized, okay, I've got these documents that refer to Antifa Dallas-Fort Worth and related entities in 2018. And the significance of the records is not just that there was an FBI inquiry. That's not really news, or it's not surprising. What was significant was that the FBI concluded in 2018 that Antifa Dallas-Fort Worth posed no threat to national security and had engaged in no criminal activity. So they closed the investigation. Now, obviously, that was 8 years ago, as a lot of people on social media pointed out to me. The point of all of it, though, is that the government...
They're good at that, because the trolls on social media are good at that.
I can understand people wondering, what does this have to do with what happened in 2026? And it's not so much that it bears on the events that transpired on the night of July 4, 2025, but you have to understand that the government's case, the prosecution's case, was centered around the idea that Antifa, North Texas, Dallas-Fort Worth, which transformed itself into the Emma Goldman Book Club, at least online in terms of a Twitter account, that this group was a threat to national security, that it's dangerous, it's extremist, it's violent. And that was the centerpiece of their narrative, and arguably something that would have persuaded the jury to convict these individuals on conspiracy charges. So if that's your argument, you can't leave out documents that contradict it. The defense is entitled to any information that might benefit their clients. And the fact that attorneys filed a motion for additional law enforcement records related to a North Texas Antifa cell, and that motion was denied, and the FBI, this case is prosecuted by the DOJ, the FBI is part of the DOJ. You cannot claim that even if they were somehow unaware of this investigation, it's not, they're still, these records should have been included in discovery. And I'm not claiming that they would have changed the outcome of the case, but you could see a scenario in which the defense had the opportunity to cross-examine FBI agents on the stand about the evolution of their characterization of this entity. And they weren't given the opportunity to do that. So that's the reporting that I've done around those documents. And it's the last thing I'll say is that this is two pages of a file that has over 70 pages of records. The FBI has not yet released those records, and I've sued them, but they are taking their time, to put it diplomatically.
The judge reminded me of the way the Sacco and Vanzetti trial was actually conducted. It's actually very, very similar. How much of this could you say is also important because it's Texas? Because similar stuff happened in Broadview in Illinois, and that's not only been thrown out, but the state now has to pay all the legal fees because there was so much project going. It's hard to believe that they were doing this in Illinois, but not doing it in Texas, right? So how much of this do you think is just connected to the fact that this happened in Texas?
I think it's, yeah, you can't discount that. And people have certainly pointed that out in the context of the recent indictment against the 15 individuals in Minneapolis. And there are parallels we can make between these cases, but we also have to understand that if the Minneapolis indictment ends up at going to trial, it's going to be a very different courtroom, different composition of jurors, et cetera. I've said this before on this podcast, and I have to because Scott is, of course, someone with a lot of experience in Texas. I am not from Texas. I don't claim any kind of expertise on the sort of local and statewide legal context. But as I said before, Pittman has a reputation. He's been sanctioned by the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit itself is probably the most conservative bench in the country, and they've actually sanctioned Pittman for conduct in the courtroom. So he's a controversial figure, and his conduct during this trial certainly raised significant concerns.
Well, at sentencing, didn't he explicitly say, I'm doing this to send a message to all you people not to do this kind of?
That one, I think it was the other judge who they called in to do, but they were speaking with one voice, right? Yeah. So this was a George W. Bush appointee. I'm not familiar with.
O'Connell.
So he did say something to the effect that this was an assault on democracy. and that it would serve that. And then the administration, Kash Patel and others have said that it sets an example for what the administration is planning to do.
I mean, I just left Texas after 30 years, and this is very consistent with what's been happening there. And you're seeing professors getting fired and the courts upholding it, and this massive Islamophobic scare. And so,
yeah, absolutely.
And this particular area, and this was like by you, Scott, Dallas area, right around there.
It was north. Yeah, it was on Fort Worth, the federal.
Yeah, Fort Worth.
Fort Worth. Yeah.
And I will put this out there because it has not been reported or widely reported, as far as I know. But during jury deliberations on Thursday, the convictions were delivered on Friday. So the jury spent all of Thursday hashing out the case. There were multiple confirmed reports that there was arguing, shouting in the deliberation room, and it got so heated that a court martial had to go up to the floor and make sure that everything was okay. Now, no one really knows what was going on in the courtroom. Sorry, during those moments, but clearly there was some disagreement among the jurors. And I was not in the courtroom when the verdicts were delivered, but numerous people confirmed that at least one and probably two of the jurors looked like they'd been in tears, and at least one was visibly crying when they came out into the courtroom. You know, we may never know what really happened in the deliberation room. Jurors have not spoken publicly, but it's just worth noting that there are questions about that too.
Was there conflict between the judge and the jurors over the instructions, or?
Not that I'm aware of. The judge's instructions were quite detailed and clear. He read them verbatim. It took over an hour, right. I think. And Antifa was mentioned once in passing. So they spent all this time at trial concocting this Antifa conspiracy, and yet in the charging instructions, it was basically absent. So I'm not sure, in terms of the conversation among the jurors, whether Antifa, to what extent it played a role in their decision.
No, they also got a terrorism enhancement. And my understanding is with that is part of the reason that we have these very high sentencing, brutal sentencing, is that they it didn't allow things to run concurrently, but they stacked the sentences. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And of course, I think there were 8 or 9 different charges,
right,
included, one of which was material support to terrorists. The only charge that some of the defendants were not hit with was attempted murder. That was only Benjamin Song, and he got the stiffest sentence.
Do you have more? Or were you going to move on to, because I have one more about this.
Go for it. I have a segue that's just a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. No, because I've been following this. I used to live in Texas, and I noticed, I don't know, I just saw maybe even on Twitter, some kind of posting that there's this kind of, these folks have a new legal team, kind of a, seems like a fairly impressive group of lawyers are taking up the appeals part of it. I don't know if that's true or not, or if you.
I actually haven't seen that, but that would certainly be interesting. I think
somebody called it a dream team. I don't know. The names weren't familiar, but I know the lawyers of Houston were the big shots there. But somebody said there's this new legal team that's taken over the appeals process. Don't know if it's true or not. Just curious about that.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that. I do think one of the issues that the defendants face was the fact that each had their own legal representation. And I think to some extent they did try to, I don't know how much coordination there was among the various defense lawyers, but it was not a sort of collective movement defense.
My question, you talked about how this was not this didn't get the Antifa label until after the assassination of Charlie Kirk, which was like probably 2 months after the 4th of July noise demo. And that's where we see the Trump administration prioritize anti-fascists and anti-capitalists and anti-Christian and whatever, anti-American political forces, I guess you could say. And in many ways, this has turned out to be a sort of dream scenario for the Trump people who have been wanting to go after their political enemies in a way. And so how much of this, and we also talked about how conservative the Fifth Circuit is, and how much of this is venue shopping on the part of the Trump administration? Like you said, Kash Patel has praised this. Todd Blanche has praised this. Got a quote from Todd Blanche saying that anti-fascists better watch out, that sort of thing. But how much of this would you say is venue shopping?
I think they recognized after the Kirk assassination and after the executive order declaring Antifa a domestic terrorist organization, they recognized that they had a set of circumstances that were ready for them to exploit. I don't know that it was venue shopping. This protest and everything that happened during the protest took place in the Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area in El Dorado. The case was prosecuted very quickly. And the superseding indictment that was released in November, that's the one that articulated this North Texas Antifa cell argument. And of course, everything came together very quickly. The administration clearly wanted to use this as a kind of a test case. And they had a sympathetic judge and probably the expectation that they would be able to potentially convict. And of course, they brought in their expert witness and built the whole narrative around this North Texas Antifa cell. But we know now that that strategy is going to be replicated in many other places. The Minnesota indictment is the most recent, but I would imagine there will be others.
I would say that the federal indictment, two of the Cobb City, Cobb County 3 in Georgia around Cobb City, is actually even more of this.
Sure. And of course, the Cobb City charges from years ago, which was state level charges, but still used this.
Still going on.
Yeah, but and also made the sort of the RICO charges, which are using novel legal arguments to ensnare large numbers of activists, and not only just the activists who are on the ground engaging in organizing and protest, but the organizations that may fund and support them. So this is how the repressive apparatus gains strength, but legally through state level laws and then the various prosecutorial strategies that are deployed.
I think Minnesota is very different, though. It's first of all, Minnesotans now have this kind of heroic status over the past few months. And just I think the political environment there, not to suggest that they might not get convicted there as well. But at the same time, I think there's even a chance the charges would be dropped there. And it's very different.
Absolutely. Undoubtedly. And I don't. We'll see how that case, how that case unfolds.
No, I guess the point is, I'm careful in places like Texas.
I only have a really other question. It seems like this is setting a precedent. And can you talk a little bit about how there's like greater force, there's a greater strategy at play here on part of the Trump administration? And how do you think this will impact people who are doing, you know, anti-ICE protests?
I think the Prairie Land case has huge propaganda value because all they have to do is point to the fact that someone's going to be in prison for the rest of his life. A 32-year-old former Marine reservist and some of the others face, what, 70 years? The ripple effects of that, I'm sure, will be real. I don't know. I'm always of two minds on this because I think that sometimes the sort of imperative to stand up and protest and organize is greater than the forces that are trying to crush it. Maybe that's just wishful thinking, but like, I think that if you read through the indictment against the Minneapolis 15 or the Minnesota 15, it's almost like a how-to manual in organizing resistance against an authoritarian police state, which I thought was amusing because here they are trying to claim that these organizations, Minnesota Direct Action, is an Antifa-aligned organization and therefore a domestic terrorist entity, et cetera. They're using the same rhetorical strategy with all of these groups. But of course, things turned out very differently in Minnesota, and what ICE was effectively repelled. And I think it did shift the public narrative in a way that the administration hasn't ultimately been able to recover from. That's not to say that they're changing their policy or their strategy. I think they have changed their tactics to some extent. Mm-hmm. But people have to be smart in the face of this kind of brazen repression, right? You know that if you're going to go out and engage in a noise demo and set off fireworks, that the administration is going to claim that you were using explosives to blow up a law enforcement facility. That is no joke, right? So I'm not here to give advice. Scott, you're better at that than I am, but I guess it's going to change the way people, I don't know, it's going to require perhaps a change in tactics and maybe a larger sort of mobilization of popular protest to confront the power of the state.
It's not just this, like recently, just not far from here in Cleveland, the government raided a voting rights group that was registering people to vote, the most benign stuff imaginable. So when you're going after everybody, I think the one thing about Minnesota, we saw that every day. So it's kind of hard to portray these people who were like braving minus 10 degree weather to go up against ice in the streets. They, you know, whereas this Dallas and just occurred spontaneously, no one heard of any of these people. There was no record. There's no legacy of anything like this happening. But the one last thing I'll tell you, I always ask probably every time you've been on, is there anybody doing anything about this beyond people in the streets? Is there, or pro bono lawyers, or I never hear anybody outside of maybe a few socialists talking about this. Walls and no one in Texas, obviously, none of the Texas officials are going to say anything, but Walls and Fry, to my knowledge, haven't said anything about this in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Is there anybody at any kind of level doing anything or saying anything about
this? That's a great question. I think there was maybe one comment from Rashida Tlaib about the Minneapolis indictment, or maybe it was the Prairie Land. I think maybe she commented on the sentencing. I think very few elected officials want to touch it. Nobody wants to be tarred with the Antifa label. So I think Graham Plattner has been, they've tried to do that to him. But I do think that it'll be interesting to see how this sort of filters through the discourse as we get closer to the midterm elections. And if there are candidates who are willing to take a more of a vocal stand in defense of the right to protest, the right to assemble, the right to engage in nonviolent direct action. The Minnesota indictment is essentially a kind of an attempt to create a conspiracy over direct action organizing tactics that have been part of movements for decades.
Yeah. The southern states in the 1950s didn't go this far in going after like King and others. And the thing is, like, most Americans, I think, understand this is preposterous. And this is also ties into the surveillance state, which Americans, both right and left, are worried about. It's just quite striking that, I mean, it's not striking. The Democratic Party is cowardly. We've known that forever. But even on issues where they probably have popular support, they run away from it.
It's what's interesting is that bringing the surveillance state stuff in. So we have prosecutions in Chicago, Minnesota, Georgia, Texas, and some of the indictments are over the top, and the sentencing is over the top. But the other part is that the surveillance stuff is really picking up as well. There was the article by one of your colleagues, Daniel Boguslaw, about the surveillance of the anti-data center, right? That more and more stuff up after. I also recently saw a piece in The Intercept in the last few days about how the police are basically warning private security that there's a class war coming and we need to watch out for more Luigi Mangionis. And so the surveillance piece of anyone who has or any sort of disagreement with corporate or governmental policies really getting very much over the top as well. Algorithms searching for people's Instagram comments and Reddit comments. It's crazy.
And these are only the examples that we know about.
Yeah. I mean,
the extent to which they're using these tools to go after ordinary Americans may be much greater than we are currently aware of.
In Texas alone, I think well over 150 people were fired in the aftermath of Charlie Kirk for public comments they made.
We haven't even really talked about the relationship between the assault on the federal workforce and political repression more broadly. These things go hand in hand in some ways in terms of instilling fear in people who may have a disagreement with the government, whether you're a scientist or an activist on the street. So the Trump administration's crackdown is sometimes it can seem like a hodgepodge, but I think it is much more systematic than maybe we can even see now in the thick of it.
It also comes across as not systematic. I think it's systematic, but with Trump at the helm, it's hard to see it because he's so erratic and just moronic. Whereas I think some of the people who are doing some of this domestic policy have a little bit more of a plan.
Exactly. And ICE has said that they have some sort of database in which protesters' names and identities are being cataloged. They've since denied it. I think The Intercept was actually suing for those records. But we know with so much of this stuff, we probably won't know the whole story for several decades.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to leave it there unless Bob has anything else.
No, thanks as always. It's good talking to you, but it's also always very depressing.
At least it's Monday. You've got the rest of the week to recover, right?
Yeah, it's the 250th anniversary. 250th anniversary of the country's coming up.
Shit. Yeah. We'll get some sleep.
But I know I appreciate just letting people know what's going on because obviously we relied on the big media. We would be really worse off.
Yeah, I appreciate your work and there's a handful of journalists, maybe even more of a handful now, who do this work and go look at it in depth, like you and Will Potter and Daniel Boguslaw and folks at The Intercept. So really appreciate your work.
Anytime.
Folks, this is the Green and Red podcast, talking with Adam Fetterman, who works with Type Investigations, with Bylines and The Guardian, The Nation in these times. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. If you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit that support button, or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And until we speak again, everybody out there, make trouble and misbehave.